The Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum has given its highest award to NASA's Kepler mission team. The 2015 Trophy for Current Achievement honors outstanding work in aerospace science and technology. Now, Kepler was the first to detect Earth-sized planets orbiting other stars at distances such that those planets might harbor life. Since its launch in 2009 in March, Kepler has discovered more than 4,000 of these exoplanets. Joining me with more on this work is Dr. Steve Howell, a Kepler mission scientist at NASA Ames Research Center. Dr. Howell, thanks so much for joining me.
Hey, good morning, Tom. How are you?
I guess we gave you quite a promotion a few minutes ago, calling you your name Kepler, but we'll keep these two straight. Yeah, and so tell us about the origins of the Kepler mission and what was its basic purpose here.
Sure. The Kepler mission went through probably 10 to 15 years of development, mostly led by Dr. Bill Borucki at NASA Ames Research. And the point of the mission was always to search for other planets in similar environments to the Earth, that is, about the same size as the Earth, orbiting stars much like our sun. That was a very lofty goal, and at first, of course, many people, when you're on the cutting edge, didn't believe it was possible. And it took, as I said, a long time to convince people to get the mission going. Finally, NASA funded it. It was launched in 2009, and today is just a complete, fantastic success.
And it's a telescope, correct?
It is. It's a space telescope, but it doesn't orbit the Earth. It orbits the sun. It's slightly smaller than the Hubble Space Telescope. And the reason to orbit the sun and not the Earth is if you orbit the Earth gets in your way a lot. It covers about half your sky you can look at. It gets in the way, and it's also not a very great stable environment. So if you orbit the sun, you get away from all the unstableness of orbiting the Earth, and you can look anywhere at all in the sky that you want, completely unbothered by the Earth.
So you could say that the Kepler itself is a kind of man-made planet.
Absolutely, yeah. It'll orbit the sun for a long time.
And so also, I guess, the scientists, including yourself, on the Kepler mission developed a novel technology or technique for detecting planets on distant stars. Describe that for us.
Yeah, so the idea of detecting these planets is to use this technique called a transit. And if you watch a star and you measure the star's brightness, if a planet has the correct orbital inclination and passes directly in front of that star, while you can't image the actual planet and star, but you can see the very slight drop in light, you can measure that is caused when the planet blocks some of the starlight. And that very, very small drop in light is what Kepler measures for planets. That's how it discovers planets. And that's incredibly sensitive and can find, as you mentioned earlier, planets as small as the Earth or even smaller.
And how far out does it look? That is to say, is it looking mainly within our local galaxy, or does it look even further than that?
Sure. So Kepler itself, when we had the prime Kepler mission, it stared at one field of view in our galaxy for 4 years. And on average, the stars that it was observing were about 3,000 light years away. That's pretty far, but they still were in our galaxy.
The other difficult thing, or the subtle thing, is not just the existence of the planet caused by the sort of blinking that you described, but also knowing how far from the star the particular planet you detect actually is.
That's right. So if you measure two or three or four transits, that gives you an orbital period for the planet, because every time it makes one orbit around the star, you see one of those transits. And using, amazingly, Kepler's laws, developed by Johannes Kepler centuries ago, you can determine approximately the orbital distance of that planet from its host star. And if it sits at just the right distance, depending on what kind of star, then you can ascertain that that planet could be a planet that would have about the same amount of light and heat energy that we receive from our sun, and therefore might be able to contain habitable life.
We're speaking with Dr. Steve Howell, a Kepler mission scientist at the NASA Ames Research Center. And how is the program structured? Is it purely within NASA? Do you have corporate partners? And do you have international partners working on this?
So the program is a NASA-funded mission. But basically, every country in the world is represented with scientists that are involved in helping us analyze the data, in making new discoveries, in telling us what objects to observe. It's become an incredible international project with science around the world being involved.
And just tell us, how big is the Kepler telescope, like size of a bread box, size of a school bus?
Yeah, it's roughly the size of a school bus. It's a one-meter telescope, if that means anything to some of your listeners. So it's about half the size in mirror diameter of the Hubble Space Telescope.
All right, but do they ever interact with one another or completely separate channels?
Well, they're completely separate projects, but there is a lot of work that other telescopes, including the Hubble Space Telescope, do to prove that the things Kepler discovers are actually planets. So while we have about 4,000 planet candidates, about 1,000 of those are actually confirmed or validated as actual planets. And that usually requires some additional work by telescopes on the Earth or also telescopes in space like Hubble.
All right, I was at the award ceremony, sitting halfway up in the chairs there during that Smithsonian presentation. And the older gentleman that accepted the award on behalf of the Kepler mission, to me, seemed to get almost beyond science and into philosophy, because he said if there's 1,000 possible planets that are a habitable, life-supporting distance from their particular suns or the stars they orbit around, he asked, you know, why haven't we heard from any of them? What's going on there? Why do we not have some more evidence of life, which seemed to get a little bit into philosophy more than science? Tell us that phenomenon and how it affects the team.
Yeah, so the older gentleman was the father of Kepler. That's Bill Borucki, who started this idea decades ago. And the philosophy he got into is called the Fermi paradox. It's this famous paradox that Enrico Fermi talked about early in the 1940s, I believe, or 1950s. Where the idea was, if there's lots of planets like the Earth, then how come we haven't heard from other planets? Why haven't we communicated with them? And Kepler has now proven that in one patch of the sky where we've looked, if you extrapolate that number even to within our own galaxy, there would be millions of planets that should be similar to the Earth in terms of the chances of life developing on those planets. So the idea is, if there are these millions of planets, why haven't we heard from them? And you might turn the argument around and say, well, how many planets have we communicated with? I mean, how much have we tried? How possible was our technology at this level to do that? And, you know, one answer is these are far apart. As I mentioned earlier, 3,000 light years is a typical distance to a planet in the Kepler field of view. That's a long way. And so not only would it take 3,000 years for a communication to get from the Earth to that planet and 3,000 years to get back to us, you say, okay, well, that's 6,000 years, so if they had sent it 3,000 years ago or something, we'd hear it by now. But it takes an incredible amount of energy to send a signal that far and have it still be coherent at the other end. And the other end has to be waiting to receive it and even understand what they're receiving.
So maybe another couple of millennia we'll all figure it out on both ends.
Maybe. You know, it's a great goal that I think now we have a little more motivation to work toward.
Now, you had a quick scare a couple of years ago when the Kepler seemed to wink out, but then you got it restarted.
Yeah, so like all telescopes in space, you point a telescope by using reaction wheels, and they're basically like little gyroscopes, and you spin them very fast in one direction or the other, and by small changes in that spin rate, you can point the telescope very precisely, and you can either move it to a different pointing or you can hold it very precisely in one pointing. So Kepler was launched with 4 reaction wheels. It needs 3 to keep the 3 axes stabilized in space. And in July of 2012 and May of 2013, we lost 2 of those reaction wheels. So that was really a defining moment in the Kepler mission. It was a sad week or two, or maybe a sad month or two, where we believed the Kepler mission was in fact over. We lost our reaction wheels. We could no longer point at the Kepler field of view. However, with some clever planning and some work by Ball Aerospace, who was the contracting company that built the telescope, and some scientific forethought by myself and the community, we developed the K2 mission, where we take the 2 remaining reaction wheels, which can only hold us stable in 2 of the 3 orientations, but we use the pressure of the light of the sun pushing on the solar panels of the spacecraft to provide us something like a 3rd reaction wheel. It provides us a 4th and a 3rd dimension that we can balance again. And hence the K2 mission was born.
And so my final question is, you may have just proven a theory I've always had, and that is you can hear light. Yes or no?
You can certainly hear light if you turn it into sound somehow. But in space, light is a tremendous pressure. If on the Earth, if you shine a flashlight on your hand, you don't feel much. But if you were in space and the sun was shining on you, it can push you along quite well.
All right,
solar sails, for example.
All right, the things we learn on this show. Dr. Steve Howell is a Kepler mission scientist at NASA Ames Research Center. Thanks for joining us, and keep on looking for those planets.
Great. Thanks, Tom. Enjoy.